This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So, the president ordered a hit on an Iranian military leader. The media chewed on it for about a week. Iran effected a bloodless retaliation. The media mostly called the crisis over, and the president left that up in the air. Meanwhile, the anxiety of the media-consuming public shifted momentarily from politics to war, and not least on social media platforms inhabited mostly by people born in the mid-90s to 2010, dubbed Generation Z. There you could find the trending hashtag World War III. On TikTok, home to micro music video memes and dominion mostly of the Zoomers, apocalyptic anxiety appeared in post after post, many centered on premonitions of a military draft. Young men tore up fake draft letters or unironically resigned themselves to duty.
I'm a soldier now. I shouldn't cry. I'll see you in 6 months.
Many drew upon video game lore. Some imagined themselves dancing to dodge bullets. Young women, dreading a more inclusive draft, furiously pantomimed mid-century domesticity, joking, "Women belong in the home. Please don't draft me." These memes were dark. One opened with the caption, "Children in 2070 buying the new video game Call of Duty World War III." Then the TikTok user was shown lying on the ground with the caption, "Me under Iranian soil." And some skipped the jokes and just said what they felt.
Bro, to be honest, I don't really know if I should believe in all the World War III stuff, but if it's true, I'm kind of scared, so.
The interesting thing about these reactions is how quickly World War III became a theme, a kind of symbol for that concern. There was no indication that a conventional war was imminent, let alone a war at a global scale.
Ian Bogost, Georgia Tech professor and contributing writer at The Atlantic, says that as unrelated to geopolitical realities these posts may have been, a very real generational view emerged.
What World War III means to me as someone who grew up during the Cold War, it was a fear as nuclear weapons amassed on both sides that all of humanity could be annihilated all at once. And with Iran, there has been a concern about their nuclear aspirations, but as far as we know, they're not in possession of nuclear weapons. So all of these things suggest just how kind of murky, how cloudy, how much of a lack of knowledge was driving these posts, which I say not to point out ignorance among the young people, but rather to suggest that this response was interpretive, right? It wasn't necessarily about the news. It was about their own feelings and about a kind of desire to find some sort of comfort in uncertainty.
Comfort? I mean, you take the ramping up of conflict between Iran and the U.S., but how do you turn that into a conflict that brings the whole world into flames, reinstitutes the draft, has people staring in the mirror saying, "I'm scared"? Where's the comfort in that?
The fantasy of a global war of the World War III sort, while it would be horrific, of course, harkens back to a time when there was greater simplicity, or at least a perception of greater simplicity. The notion of World War II in particular was one in which there were clear good and evil, or at least a perception that there was clear good and evil, where conventional war was the kind of thing that everyone could get behind. And so by invoking this symbol of the World War in general and World War III in particular, you're able to sort of reoccupy a time, you know, kind of between the 1950s and the 1980s, when even though there was great uncertainty, we had a lot of concerns about the threat of nuclear annihilation, things felt simpler, or our memory is that they were simpler. We had national states that were responsible for warfare. There were not that many of them. And today we have, after Vietnam, after the destabilization of war during the 1980s and 1990s, the rise of non-national actors like militias and guerrilla forces, and we have asymmetric warfare. You know, all of these things are uncertain now.
You're talking about a period before the end of the Cold War when, for good or ill, there was a recognizable world order, even though there was a tremendous amount of moral ambiguity during that period and continues, and of course, through every war, even the ones that seem simple. But my question is about the Zoomers, is that they weren't born before 1980. So what I saw were young people drawing from cinema and comic books and television.
Yeah, this is cultural memory and received ideas, which of course become nostalgized. They become a kind of fantasy that never really existed. And, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, during the 1990s, we saw this enormous rise in kind of apocalypse films, big budget Hollywood blockbusters, whether it was about asteroids or aliens or what have you. We needed, culturally, we needed something to replace that threat of nuclear destruction in order that we could feel like we could rally around it. And, you know, a lot of those films show humanity coming together to push the asteroid off course or what have you.
One thing that seemed weird about the World War III memes is that even though they appear to be anti-war, they also buy into its inevitability.
Mm-hmm. It is just very interesting that by invoking that phrase, you're not necessarily in support of military action of any kind. You're not necessarily a detractor of that action. You're almost sort of just kind of testing the waters of this question, well, what if it were real? How would it play out today? And how would that be different than it was in the past? And am I ready for it? All of those ways of practicing for the idea that there might be another conflict to worry about on top of all the other worries that we have in our world today. I think that's what the hashtag, what the memes are for. They're kind of acting out or a kind of therapeutic process of thinking about geopolitical uncertainty, not necessarily about Iran specifically or the consequences of this specific event. One of the criticisms that I saw of these posts was like, look, you kids in middle America or wherever, you've got nothing to worry about. It's the civilians on the ground in the Middle East who are going to pay the price. If there is that kind of a concern for the fate of those who are really in the line of fire in this region, I don't know that that's necessarily the kind of thing that we saw, at least in the posts that I witnessed.
We didn't see any of those.
Yeah, there's a certain, you know, narcissism to posting on social media at all, which of course is going to play out in concerns about one's own personal welfare in the face of global conflict.
Obviously, it's not the first time that kids on TikTok express their anxieties there. It just has a different hashtag.
You know, a year or two ago, nobody knew that TikTok existed. And I think it's important not to fetishize these platforms or point to them as some sort of novel generational rift, but rather that it's probably representative of something deeper, something more ongoing. And to me, that ongoing thing, that sort of ultimate cause of which the posts are proximate causes, is this, on top of everything else, more geopolitical unrest as the new year turns. And I thought I was going to be, you know, able to enjoy a few more days of school break or whatever. Here is another performance of that uncertainty on behalf of all of the forces that are out of my control. And I think that's the pattern that we will see recur, not necessarily with respect to warfare, but whatever the next thing is. And there certainly will be a next thing.
You wrote that the end of the world could be a, quote, dark but deviously appealing fantasy. And you were talking about your own experience as a Gen Xer during the Cold War. What seemed soothing about the apocalypse back then?
The idea that you live at the end of history is incredibly comforting. Even if you don't know everything that happened in the past, there will be none who follow you. You've seen it all, either personally or historically. You haven't missed anything in the project that is humankind.
That's FOMA taken to the nth degree, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you know, the fear of annihilation is a particularly piquant version of the fear of death. It's about not seeing what comes next for your progeny, for humanity at large. It makes sense to me that there would be some comfort, even if it's a perverse comfort, in everyone being together at the end.
And so for a person in 2020, a young person, What's the meaning to be found in apocalyptic dreaming? What are they dreaming of?
Yeah, it's almost like a dream of a better kind of apocalypse than the one that they might face, which, you know, we're sort of nth order perversity here. But when you think about something like the climate crisis, it's a slow burn. We're kind of slowly snuffing ourselves out. That's a different kind of threat of annihilation than the one day when everyone kind of knows it's coming and the news stories tell you, well, take shelter, do the best you can, we don't know what's next, but it was nice knowing you. So I think it's this fantasy for a better kind of end than the one that the youngest generation feels like they might face.
Ian, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Ian Bogost is a professor at Georgia Tech and a contributing writer to The Atlantic.
Coming up, we consider how history depicts apocalypse. Like, how come we still don't know why the Roman Empire fell?
This is On the Media.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.